Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to be continuing our conversation with Greg Lehman. This is the second part of a two-part series. Greg has recently joined SEMA Partners as a co-leader in the healthcare and medical device practice. He's a seasoned CEO, has served on numerous boards, both in public companies as well as private. And he has, early in his career, he was a president of a college. He has just some great background in leading organizations to growth, and looking forward to today's conversation with Greg. So you talk about shared vision of growth, kind of that partnership of talk a little bit more about that. Kind of what is that? How do you set the table as far as with private equity?
Yeah, I think the first thing that I do after, I walk in the door is really just kind of manage by walking around, getting to know the people. Of course, I had met them before, but I think walking around and sitting down with them on a pretty frequent basis just to define, what's working in their job, what are they frustrated about, all of those types of things, and educate them on how private equity reacts because they've never had that experience before. So the things I have in my checklist are, what's your customer base look like? What's the concentration? Do you just have 10 really large customers and then 200 very small ones? Do we have enough managerial depth on the team? Do we need to shore that up? I would say inconsistent or non-recurring revenue. In other words, their churn for customer retention and attrition is not acceptable. So you need to find out why. It's why people are leaving and what can you do to keep them. And I think that's really important. And then I also look at, do we have what I call an institutionalized business development program to not only attract customers, but also manage their expectations as a new customer, because oftentimes there's some hiccups there. I've experienced this in many companies, very poor or lack of sophisticated IT or technology. And, that's hard to scale a business with a lot of antiquated manual processes. So that's very important. And then the other thing is a lot of these processes that are not automated, you can't scale the business because you have to add FTEs as opposed to just streamlining and automating. As an example, with the last fund that I worked for, we actually decreased our staff when they left to take other jobs. We didn't have to fill the position because we automated. When I started looking at their IT, for example, we had automation of about 10 or 15% of the functions. And by the time I left, we were at 95% of the functions were automated. And that doesn't mean a human doesn't touch it, but they can do more things in a repetitive fashion without having to manually fill out forms and contact information. And it's very clunky. So I worry about how can we scale the business through technology. And so that's one of the big things that I look at. The other thing, Mark, that I think is important is while growth is important and every PE fund will say, I want more sales. And I always say, so do I. But how we get there is important. And so I like to say, build the foundation before you put the pedal down and try to grow the business. And by that, I mean, that's part of the IT interoperability and automation that you perform. But it's also about aligning incentives. Are the sales professionals high commission, low base, higher base? lower commission, and how can you scale that? And a lot of times you scale it almost too quickly and you don't have the foundation laid, and there's high turnover and you get sloppy in hiring. So you need to hire the right professionals, again, using a good executive recruiting firm who has subject matter expertise in finding commissioned salespeople or sales leaders. That's really important. So you have to have your foundation laid before you build the structure and for rapid growth. And by rapid growth, what do I mean? I think most PE funds are going to expect on the low end, 10% growth a year, but ideally they want 20 to 25% growth a year. And that's hard to do year over year, but that's the expectation.
I heard you, I had you give a talk to some business leaders in the Twin Cities when you were a CEO here of a med tech company. And you talked about the concept of CEO as champion. Unpack that, what you mean by that and how that kind of plays out in day-to-day.
I think the context of that statement was basically the CEO needs to be articulating what the strategy is and why the strategy is the way it is and what are the components of that to all of the employees, not just the executive team. And in many cases, the employees are doing a function, but they don't know how it really fits into the strategic direction of the business. So I think the champion has got to be the CEO championing the direction of the business. How are we going to get there? How are we doing against those metrics? And I would address all the employees about once every 2 months in a town hall meeting. And then I also took five or six people from each department and had a lunch and learn with them once a month. And it was never everybody from the same department. It was a mixture. And when we started doing some really exciting projects like lean manufacturing and all of those types of sexy acronyms that are out there, they understood why and they were excited about it. And when I took the time to tell them what's working well, where do we still have some issues, the corporate culture became very cohesive and all pulling in the same direction. And the naysayers either left or jumped on board. And I found that's what CEO being the champion actually means to the business.
Talk about the sense of urgency within the company.
Right. That's an interesting topic. And what I was talking about to the group in my speech was, in many cases, you plan, but you're slow to execute. And by that time, you know, you find out that the market has passed you by or you've lost a competitive advantage. And a sense of urgency is you have to have the plan, but you have to pull the trigger and execute on the plan and make sure you have metrics to measure how you're doing against the plan. And in many cases, it's tied to the annual budget. But in oftentimes, the executive team has, you know, management by objectives, MBOs, where they actually have a dashboard that they're monitored. They monitor themselves, but also me in terms of determining what their pay should be, what their bonus should be. Even though we have metrics, we had to have a way to measure those metrics and then, you know, reward or not reward based on accomplishment.
As a CEO, you have a dashboard that you're working off, the critical things that you're focused on. Talk about just that process of what you do as far as to figure out, okay, what is it that we need to focus on this quarter, this year? Talk a little bit about that.
There's always the tyranny of the urgent, Mark. And that is, you know, I've got to get to this. It's the most important thing. And in many cases, it's a time drag and it takes longer than expected. You know, I always say that IT the IT programs that the head of IT wants to do, they always take twice as long and cost twice as much. And you've heard that old saw, and it's probably true. So I look at it this way, and I think the dashboard is very important. I think there has to be some very high level, this is my annual goal of things that we need to accomplish. Then the priority of how to bite those off. And some of it has to do, let's take the example, the medical device. You need to get FDA approval in many cases. And if there's a problem, the urge is to just address the problem and put everything else to the side. And you may have some equipment backlogged that you need to produce for a revenue generating customer. And so you may say, this is a new generation of equipment. I'm going to downsize the team that works on the FDA approval format and basically concentrate on getting equipment completed that's already been approved by the FDA and out the door. So there's always a tendency to stop the press. Let's fix everything. And then let's start the business back up. You just can't do that. So that's what I really mean by creating the dashboard. And I also say, just like a budget, there are unexpected things that happen once you create and approve what everybody's going to be working on and the timeline of how to do it. But when I mentioned the tyranny, the urgent, there are always things that come up that are going to be distractions, and but things you need to deal with so that you don't damage the business or customer expectations or even customer loyalty. It's a very delicate tightrope that you need to walk. And I found that, once you in a staff meeting, which are usually weekly, I like to go through, let's talk about these four initiatives that we started 3 weeks ago, and let's see how we're doing against those. And let's have a roundtable discussion as to, can any of us help get some of these projects across the finish line and make sure we get back to then the legacy business, as I like to call it. But there's a lot of spinning plates on a stick that you have to keep spinning so they don't drop. But it's just a matter of getting the team on the same page. That's really what it's all about. And then helping them in a collaborative fashion, as opposed to building a little wall around your office and say, I'm only responsible for this. No, we're all responsible for the business. You just have some responsibilities that are well defined. So we all need to be pulling in the same direction.
Talk about a situation. Maybe I don't know if you've had this where you've gone into a leadership role where there was no vision for changing what was there. It was the status quo. And you mentioned in your talk around creating a vision for change. And, I think sometimes when things are going well, sometimes people get comfortable and they go, okay, we don't need to ever, fix this. It's going well and we're not having to tweak anything, but talk a little bit about that.
I would say in 70% of my CEO job, both private and public companies, there was a contingent of people, the first month that said, it's working fine, and we don't need to make any changes because change is disruptive. And I said, change for the sake of change is disruptive. Change to accelerate the business trajectory is critical. And so, in many cases, it you need to change some of the leadership team who are content with the way the business is running. You need to also address, what is broken, actually, because in many cases it is, but it's kind of hanging together by a few threads. And you need to address that and shore up the core, as I like to say, before you start to take on other strategic initiatives. So it's a process. It ties with the question about sense of urgency, actually. And while you still have to have a sense of urgency, you need to get the team to have buy-in and share that sense, that burden of the sense of urgency while they're still running their departments. And in some cases, that takes delegation. in some other cases, you know, somebody has to be the owner, but have a team working on a project. It just depends what it is.
I think whenever there's change that needs to be made, especially in the C-suite, you're brought in, you either inherit a team or you've brought people in and they're, you realize that they're not in the right spots or they're not in the right company. They're just not a great fit. How do you make that change and how do you do it in a way that's honoring of the person as well as the mission that you have to see the company move forward?
That's probably the most emotionally difficult part of being a CEO by far. And, you know, it's because they've been loyal soldiers. They have, you know, in some cases I've had to remove people that have been there 35 or 40 years. They just weren't meeting expectations. And if a CEO says it doesn't bother me to fire people, something's wrong. You know, we're family, and yet we have a fiduciary responsibility to produce growth and profitability for the shareholders or the owners. So what I like, you know, and I really rarely sleep very well the night before I need to do this. But what I do is I address the behavior or the lack of good behavior and productivity, not the person. So I never criticize and belittle the individual. I just tell them that, you know, here's the direction we need to be going. You have helped get us to where we are today, but I think what we need going forward is just a different skill set. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a soft landing. You know, we can call it retirement. We can call it whatever you feel comfortable with. I want you to have leave with dignity. And I also want to provide references for you if you need them. But in many cases, make sure they have a severance package, make sure they understand COBRA and keeping their health insurance. But it's never easy. But in many cases, Mark, I think the person knew that was coming and dreaded the day, but in some cases they were miserable in their job. And so you just had to help them find a different alternative.
So you talk about, and I've heard you talk about short-term wins of setting up, again, just going in as a new leader. What are some things that you did? You talked about, you know, that 60 to 90 days of kind of getting the feel for the organization. Did you take like that information and just say, okay, what can we do right away that could help the business move forward? And how did you prioritize that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think celebrating early and small wins is extremely important to make sure everybody, you know, it's easy to criticize somebody's work. It's more difficult to give them praise and encouragement when something goes right. And I'm a big believer that you celebrate any and all of the wins, even if they're just small, to recognize people. So it can be in a town hall meeting. It can be in an inner office email, but just give some kudos and celebrate the wins. We used to, when we had a win, we would have pizza Fridays and we would all, you know, the company would buy it. Some cases I bought it and we would have a pizza party in our cafeteria and I'd give a little talk and call on some people and celebrate the wins. And that, it did a lot for morale, but it also kept us working collaboratively as a team, as opposed to kind of being on an island and doing things in your own way and in your own time, unfortunately. So I think that's important. I look at it this way: as you celebrate each little win, and then you get to the end of the year and you've had a really good year and you've hit your numbers, that's the big win. And so we'll do, you know, give people some time off and not even count it toward PTO. Just, you know, it's just creative things. We would take them to a baseball game, a riverboat cruise in Minneapolis. We just did a lot of things to celebrate big and little wins. But to get the big win, you have to have a lot of little wins in order to do that.
What did, when we first interviewed, our first interview, it was pre-COVID. So it feels like it's been a decade ago. Anything that you've learned during COVID that maybe has carried over into what you do today?
Oh, definitely. You know, I think that's assuming, of course, that we're post-COVID. I know there's still some cases popping up here and there, but being able to pivot, and I don't use that word lightly, but we saw the tidal wave of COVID-19 coming and started stockpiling computers, laptops, monitors, printers, and making sure the employees had high-speed Wi-Fi internet connection. And so when markets started to shut down, we were one of the first to do that in terms of having everybody migrate to the home-based setting. And I thought, well, when the pandemic subsides, we'll just go back. Then we started looking at, why are we paying all this money and renewing leases when we have no visibility as to how long this is going to last, and we're paying for something we're not using. And in many cases, paying twice because we had to buy new equipment for everybody to be home-based. And of course, a lot of our employees had young children, so daycare shut down, and it was a lot of tough sledding for several months, and probably for almost 2 years. So one of the lessons learned is we don't need as many office spaces and cubicles as we used to. And the reason being is we did a survey kind of early in the pandemic, midway through and towards the end. And we found that at least half of the workforce preferred to stay in a home-based setting because of the type of work that they did. It was, you know, processing claims, call center, different things like this. But they also said, we miss our colleagues. And so we kept a smaller footprint of offices in our markets. And in some markets, we abandoned the complete office space. And people started rotating in 1 to 2 days a week. And I've talked to a lot of executives in the last year, and they said this pretty much the same thing. We're going back to work, but not at full complement, so we can downsize some of our space. And we have people come in on different days of the week so they can still do teamwork types of things and the camaraderie that's normally not there when you're trying to keep your dogs from barking and your kids from screaming or, you know, making faces in the camera. We found that productivity remained very high and in some cases even higher, because when you were working, you were working and there were no distractions in some cases, in most cases. And, you know, we could downsize and not miss a lick. And so a lot of my colleagues around the country have done the same thing, with a few exceptions. So some accounting firms had to be on site, you know, consulting firms, maybe not so much. But, you know, those labor intensive industries, they needed to get back. But I just think it's changed our mindset in terms of what we really truly need and how much we need to spend if productivity doesn't miss a lick and the company continues to grow. So that's one of the takeaways. And I found too that we had to be very innovative by how we use technology. And so we did a pivot with that as well. And that's when, you know, on the previous comment that I made about shoring up your IT, shoring the core, we found out we could do some things that our IT staff didn't think they could. We outsourced some, we did it internally, but we changed the whole look and feel of the business, the internal business, let's put it that way, the operational staff, you relied more on technology post-pandemic. And so I think when you see medical device companies or healthcare service companies, you see this plethora of new online tools, whether it's talking to physicians, whether it's reaching out to elderly people to keep them in their home with monitoring equipment, with and a lot of this spawned, it was germinated during the pandemic, sure, where you keep them out of the hospital, you lower costs, but you also don't spread infection. And so we've figured out not only how to be nimble, but how to do things faster, better, more cost effective. And I think that will stay post pandemic.
Well, those are definitely some trends. Any other trends you're seeing in healthcare and the med device world that you're excited about?
Yeah, let me start with med devices. And one of the things, based on my experience, that I've seen a lot of new startups. So those of you that are listening to the podcast that are working with venture capital, in I call them non-invasive or minimally invasive medical devices. So, for example, people with epilepsy, you know, they have brain monitors that can, you know, be little implanted probes that monitor your brain activity and prevent a seizure. There's also, you know, just a lot of monitoring for diabetes patients, for example, that you don't have to do a finger stick anymore. You can almost do things virtually. But I see that as a trend that started to pick up toward the midpoint of the pandemic. And there's a lot of venture capital funded startups that are starting to really hit that inflection point that I think will be here to stay. So the lesson learned is we were forced by necessity to be creative, innovative, and provide the capital, which is there because they didn't spend a whole lot during the pandemic. It's there to help young entrepreneurs get their foot in the door, get funding. And a lot of these are exciting new companies that I see continuing.
So I know you're a reader. Anything that you read in the last 4 years that I know you gave us a long list last time as far as the books that you recommend to leaders, anything that that you're referring to leaders these days?
Well, you know, I think one of the authors that I enjoy reading is Stephen Covey, obviously. I like to read things about people that have really succeeded. So whether they're biographies or autobiographies, you know, I study the methodology of guys like Warren Buffett, and, you know, even some that are unconventional, Elon Musk comes to mind. And you know, I learn things from them, like the sense of urgency, but also sometimes doing a knee jerk and then having to follow up and say, I did it too soon. So I like to look at not so much textbooks, but life stories and anecdotes that inspire me to look at the business and look at life a little bit differently.
So any parting advice that you would give a new or up-and-coming leader?
Yes, and I think this is going to sound a little pedantic, and I look at new CEOs and I say, look, you're not going to know everything. You don't have to know everything. But don't be afraid to ask questions of former CEOs, of your predecessor, of the board, of your team. The first time I ran a public company, I told the CFO, I have no idea what to do in an earnings call. And he said, I'll teach you. And after the second call, I wasn't nervous anymore. I kind of knew what to expect, what you can say and cannot say as a publicly traded company, especially around guidance. Sure. And I stumbled a few times, but I learned that. So that dovetails into the advice, be transparent, admit that you don't know something, but ask people for their advice. You were brought in because you have the tools to be a successful CEO, but you can't learn it from a book necessarily, but you can learn it from those that preceded you in the seat and also your existing team. And in many cases, that's how you can effectively use the board. If it's private equity or public, you have people on the board that are subject matter experts. Don't be afraid to ask for help. And they're usually flattered to answer that. I met with my board chairman once every 2 weeks for lunch, and it was a working lunch. And he would ask about the business, and then I would ask him questions and say, if you were sitting in my chair, what would you do? And in many cases, he wouldn't answer me. He would say, tell me what you think you should do and let me critique it. So I thought that was very important. And so I would say, stick close to your board chairman, your board members, utilize them, not just for company updates, but for brainstorming. And as you get more comfortable, they'll call on you more for your thoughts as opposed to you asking them for their thoughts. It just takes time. I usually tell CEOs, give it a year, dust yourself off, and then hit the ground running for year two. Year one is getting a feel for the business, the culture. Is it right? Does it need tweaking? Your relationship with the board, it's going to evolve. But by year two, you should be fully engaged and able to run with the rest of the horses.
Well, this has been great as always. I always enjoy our conversations. And Greg, I wish you continued success and looking forward to working closely with you and our new venture. And thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Mark. I enjoyed it very much. And I look forward to working with you and all you future people that we're going to hopefully be talking to down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.